from Knoxville, Tennessee.
Hi, my name is Heather Ganziano and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Hello, San Diego. First of all, let me thank the committee, Lauren and the committee, for the honor and the privilege at speaking at your conference. It's truly an honor. I've heard some amazing speakers because trust me, I needed them. It's been one of those weeks and I have delved in. You guys are amazing. It's been a rock show. So thank you so much. So I'm going to get into my talk. I'll give you the particulars because quite frankly, I like to judge a speaker myself. So my sobriety date is April 8th, 1990. I have a sponsor. Her name is Pat Yo, and my home group is the Tennessee Group in Knoxville, Tennessee. And if you come to Knoxville on a Thursday night, the doors open at 6 o'clock. There's greeters at the door. And if we don't know who you are, we'll say, hey, is this your first meeting? We'll bring you in. We will introduce you to everybody. We'll make sure you get a big book and a phone list. And we kind of huddle around you. And the meeting starts at 7. It's a closed literature-based AA meeting. And we have somebody share for about 15 minutes, and then they read from a piece of AA approved literature, and then there's participation, and we actually do something crazy. We share on the topic, and if we see you're wavering on the topic, we will steer that ship right back because we're solution based. It's not a piss and moan meeting. Do you feel me? It's just hardcore AA. I dig it. And so it's interesting, when I moved to Knoxville like 8.5 years ago, I would go to meetings and I would call Pat, and I'd get out of a meeting and I'm like, oh, I had such an acute case of bleeding deaconism. I'd call her and I go, oh my God, they're doing AA wrong. I said, it's like anarchy here. It's amazing that anybody stays sober. I'm going to another meeting because I have so many resentments. And that's what I did in the beginning. I said, I'm going to start a meeting. She goes, you're not going to start a meeting for 5 years. You're going to suit up and show up and be of service and be an AA member in Knoxville. And so 5 years and one day later, a friend of mine, Marion, had moved from Lancaster, California to Knoxville. We started this meeting, and people in Knoxville said, nobody are going to go to a meeting like that. We don't believe in structured AA here. Nobody's going to show up. Nobody's going to take a year-long commitment. On the first day we opened the doors, our first meeting had 45 people. In pre-COVID, we are the largest meeting in East Tennessee, averaging between 100 and 125 people every Thursday night. If you build it, they will come. People want their starving and dying for Alcoholics Anonymous. And so it just goes to show you. Anyway, so we had an anniversary eat and speak. And when we do that, we make the entrees and we invite you to bring the side dishes and the desserts. And I'm what they call a kitchen witch. Me and Jeff cook in the kitchen for our anniversary dinner. And I just want you to understand the reason I'm telling you this. I want you to understand the keen intellectual mind that is seated before you, okay? So I decided to make pot roast for our anniversary eat and speak. And I wanted it to stay on the table and stay nice and hot. So I went online and Googled, how do you keep your meat hot? Now I get a bunch of erectile dysfunction ads. And if I want to meet a hot chick, I'm all set, you know? That's the brain that is seated before you. So it's funny, I was watching some football with my son just before the season ended this year. And I looked at my phone and I got another erectile dysfunction ad and I showed it to him. He goes, my God, I cannot believe you're my gene pool. Anyway, so let me tell you about what I was like. I grew up at the foothills of East Tennessee, right at the base of the Smoky Mountains. And I was the most nervous, neurotic kid you've ever seen. I was a hand wringer. I was a worrier. You guys, I worried when I didn't worry about not worrying. Do you know what I mean? So I believe with everything that I am, that alcohol absolutely saved my life until it didn't. That is to say that I had no coping skills and no ability to do life on life's terms, you know? I was this dark, morose kid. I would ride my bicycle in the front yard and think, if I crashed and died here, wouldn't everybody be sad? I was constantly planning my funeral. I was dark. Do you know what I mean? And by the time I was like 7 or 8, I had developed a peptic ulcer. You know, I was a worrier from the gate. So I will tell you about my first drink. Some people don't remember theirs. I do. My mom had had a cocktail party. There were all these clear plastic glasses in the living room, and she and her friend were in the kitchen doing the dishes. And I went through the living room and I'm pouring one cup into another and one cup into another, and nobody's looking. And I take a big swig off of it, and there's that lime floating around and the ice is melted. And I remember the burn of the vodka in my mouth, and I remember the bitterness the quinine and the tonic, and I remember it going down my throat, and I remember it hitting my stomach, and I remember emptying every glass I could in that room, and my shoulders, for the first time in my uptight, hand-wringing life, went down. You know, I felt like I exhaled for the first time. Now, if you're new, let me just tell you, no matter how many times I tell that story, I have a Pavlovian response, and that is that my mouth begins to salivate every time I describe alcohol like that. If you're new, that's not normal. Normal people don't talk about the beads of sweat glistening down the beer bottle, and they don't have to say things like, gosh, I'm sorry, I slept with your husband, you know. And they don't make a Hallmark card for that, by the way. You know, my husband likes to say, gee, Heather, one would have to go to a truck stop to meet a woman of your quality. I think he means it as a compliment, but I'm not really sure. Anyway, in addition to, you know, being neurotic and a hand wringer and having this peptic ulcer, my mom took me to a doctor because she thought maybe I needed to calm down. And there's some outside issues in my story, but in the interest of singleness of purpose, I identify only as an alcoholic. Simply alcohol did everything for me. It was my answer to everything, but I was put on a sedative to sedate me a little to see if that would stop the peptic ulcer. It did not. I did remember, though, I liked the way it made me feel. So anyway, so I'm this little neurotic kid, and my house was the house on the corner where the grass was growing 3 feet high, and the neighbors would put a note on the door and say, please mow your lawn, you're making the neighborhood look bad. And my house was the house where I come home from school and I'd go to flick the light switch on, but the lights wouldn't come on because my mom would have taken us to a Michelin star restaurant because she would want us to experience culture. And we would spend $500 on a meal, but have no money to pay for the power bill. And we would have to eat red beans and rice. She was a bad financial planner and she made bad choices constantly. And my house was the house where my older sister was into drugs and throwing TVs across the room, and it was chaotic. And I was scared sometimes, you know, and my mom was called the divorcee. Now this is not circa 1930s or 40s. This is in the 70s. They referred to her as the divorcee of the neighborhood. Anyway, so I can tell you one of my experiences as a child was I was standing in my classroom. I was in a remedial class. I was with profoundly handicapped children that were nonverbal. I had acute learning disabilities. They didn't know what that was back then, but my teacher brought me into the classroom in front of all my peers in the fifth grade and had me read out of a second grade reader, and I couldn't. And she had a second grader come up into the classroom and in front of my peers read from the second grade reader. And she turned to me in front of my peers and said, why can't you do that? And I remember thinking, I wish I had a drink. And that was in the fifth grade. I filed that for reference that day I was in that living room. I remembered, I don't ever want to not feel like this again the rest of my life. And fast forward, you know, I'm just about to enter my freshman year of high school. And I need to tell you that I was a punk rocker in East Tennessee in the 1980s. My best friend Leslie had a big 10-inch mohawk. I had three colors in my hair. And we had a white Dodge Dart that we drove around that we painted pink polka dots on, and we just dared you to talk to us. I look like on the outside the way I felt on the inside. Do you know what I mean? It just is the way I felt. And by the time I was going into my freshman year of high school, I was playing in jazz clubs with jazz trios. And when I'd have to play in a club, I'd dull my look down. And my mom would go sit at the bar because I was a minor and I wasn't really supposed to be there. And I'd play gigs with jazz trios. And, you know, I had failed my driving test because I couldn't get a hardship license because I have learning disabilities because I'm really neurotic. So my mom takes me to a restaurant one afternoon and we're having lunch, and we had a couple of glasses of Chardonnay. I'm not going to tell you the name of the restaurant, but it was Ruby Tuesdays. Anyway, we had a few glasses of Chardonnay and a salad. And after we finished, she goes, you're going to go take your driving test. I'm like, Mom, I just had a couple of glasses of Chardonnay. She goes, good, you won't be nervous. And so we drove across the street to the Tennessee Highway Patrol, and I took my driving test and I passed. And I got to tell you, I'll never forget my son when he took his driving test and he passed. And they were, you know how they make you stand behind the red line to take your picture? He popped his head around from the camera. He says, hey, Mom, I did it without Chardonnay. It's a first for our family. It's a proud moment as a mother. Anyway, so I could drive myself to gigs now. And but when I started my freshman year of high school, God's cruel twist of fate, and this is true, I sat between two pageant queens. Can you imagine a punk rocker sitting between two pageant queens? And I don't know if you know anything about pageants, but in the South, they're huge. In the South, we have an expression. We say the bigger the hair, the closer to Jesus. These girls were loving the Lord. They were loving the Lord. They had big pageant hair, and they had kind of pageanty sounding names like Belinda June September and Sally Sue Sadler. And they would always say things like, "You're neat, great, and thank you." And I remember thinking, oh my God, I'm in hell. Hell is real, you know? And so, you know, when people say alcoholics are weak-willed, I say, nay, nay, verily I say unto thee, we are not weak-willed. What we are is laser-focused and driven. When we decide we're going to do something, we're like a pit bull. We clamped on it, and we're not going to let go until we get there. I decided that high school was the problem. That's why I didn't feel comfortable. You know, I hated my life. I was uncomfortable in my skin. That's why I was a punk rocker. And so I focused and went to summer school every year so that I could graduate early, so my life could start. Do you know what I mean? So I could get out there and have life. And so I graduated early from high school, and I moved on campus to the University of Tennessee, not to go to college, but to have my life start. And that's what I did. I just partied. And I had in addition to being on the campus and graduating early from high school, I was in children's theater and all sorts of performing things. I did gigs all over town. And there was a teacher that said, Heather, you know, you've got some real talent. You need to get out of here, either go to LA or New York and study voice. And so clamp down that pit bull, that idea, that's gonna be the things that fixes me. Knoxville's the problem. I hate country music. And if you like country music, don't tell me I don't get it. I get it, I just don't like it. I don't fit in here, I hate this place. If I just get out of here, New York City's the answer, I've decided. So I pack everything I own into one large suitcase and I moved to Atlanta, Georgia. That's as much money as I had. I couldn't get any further. And so I had to make money in Atlanta. And so in addition to being neurotic, a hand wringer, I forgot to tell you, I was also a latent bedwetter. I wet my bed until I was in grade school, about well into elementary school to the end. You know, I remember I slept at a friend's house and I woke up the next morning, I peed all over the bed, and I tried to tell her I hadn't wet the bed. I just sweat a lot. But anyway, so now I'm in Atlanta, Georgia, trying to make enough money to get to New York City. And I need to tell you that something I'm not proud of, but I used to be a professional mimist. And I know mimes are annoying, but I can assure you a drunken stoned mime is really annoying. And so I got gigs at the Dunwoody and Perimeter malls. These are high-end malls in Atlanta. And I'd be in there walking the wall and doing my deal. And one night it was really dead and the manager cut me loose early. And I'm drunk and I'm high all the time now. I'm driving back to the apartment where I'm crashing in Atlanta until I make enough money to get to New York City. And I don't know if I had an out tail light or if my tags were expired. But anyway, I got pulled over by Atlanta's finest, their highway patrol on I-75. I'm drunk, I'm high, and I'm in full mime makeup. And he motions for me to roll the window down. And I roll the window down and I go, and he looked at me and said, "Good Lord, go home." And I thought, I've heard of women sleeping with cops to get out of tickets. I myself mimed my way out of it. Anyway, so I make enough money in Atlanta to get to New York City. And you guys, New York was like a Fellini film on acid. I land in the platform at Grand Central Station with my one suitcase, and there's 40,000 people walking toward me. This little girl from East Tennessee had never seen so many people, and there were Black people with French accents and Asian people with German accents, and it was this yummy, unctuous melting pot of people. And I see all these people, and I'm like, "Hey, good morning. Hey, how are you? Hi, good to see you." And this guy walks up to me in this Brooklyn accent and says, "Not for nothing, but pull the straw out of your hair and shut your mouth." And I thought, oh. So I learned to walk around like in New York, like everybody does. If you see a body in the street, you don't do anything. You just step over it. And, you know, and so I got this apartment, which is a loose term. I got to rent a couch in 1983 in the Village, right above the West 4th Street subway and the Waverly Diner. Literally, my door was by the entrance to the West subway. I slept on a couch and I think I paid between $600 and $800 a month. And I got a gig at this restaurant in the Village called the Bebop Cafe. And this was one of those retro diners that had a big Studebaker sticking out of the front of it. And I would show up to work in the morning and I'd either still be drunk or I'd be really hungover, more likely drunk, because I just drink now all the time. It's decidedly having an effect on me. And I remember coming in one morning to the restaurant to get the restaurant open, and Frank was sitting there with a bunch of guys. He was the management of the restaurant, and they were all talking really loudly, laughing a lot. There were empty coffee pots on the table behind them, ashtrays overflowing with cigarette butts. And he looked up from his conversation. He looked at me, he goes, "We're saving you a seat, kid." And I remember looking around the restaurant and thinking, why? There's so many in the restaurant. And he would say things to me like, "You know, kid, when I drink, I break out in handcuffs." And what Frank was doing was lovingly, gently planting the seed of Alcoholics Anonymous in me. He never was grandiose. He didn't over-exaggerate. He just told stories. You know, and I am so grateful for that. I'll never forget Frank as long as I live. And I was sharing that story in Lancaster, somewhere, not Lancaster, San Bernardino, California. And I said, I found that seat you saved me, Frank. I called him and told him that. And I was sharing that from the podium. I said, I don't know if Frank is still alive, but I think about him all the time. And at the end of the meeting, this woman comes up to me and she says, "I'm in Frank's home group. I'll tell him you said hello." Don't you love Alcoholics Anonymous? I love it. You can't make that stuff up. It happens to us all the time. Anyway, so I'm in this restaurant. I'm not making enough money and I need to make more money. So I move and get a job on the Upper East Side at a very high-end restaurant. Smart, work less, make more money so I can, you know, have my life. And so I get a job at this restaurant called the Bebop Cafe in, Prima Donna's rather, Bebop Cafe was the old one, Prima Donna's in Upper East Side. And this is one of, in the 80s, restaurants would like be open, be really chic. There'd be celebrities, politicians, athletes that would go. It was hot. The restaurant would be jumping for like 2 or 3 years. The owner would shut the restaurant down, move across the street, open up a new restaurant with a new name, and that would be the hot spot. So I got this job at Prima Donna's, and I would show up to work late. I would immediately go behind the bar and I would borrow, that was the word on my inventory, I would borrow a bottle of Louis Roederer Cristal or a bottle of Perrier Jouet, which is like a $250 bottle of champagne. I'd go into the ladies' room, invite my coworkers. We'd smoke a coolie, which is a half tobacco, half cocaine cigarette. We'd take a pull off of that champagne and I'd start my shift. I'm drunk, I'm high, I've stolen from the company and I'm late. I'll never forget when I was doing my first inventory with my sponsor, she said, "Well, you're a thief." And I remember thinking, I got really indignant. I said, "I may be a drunk and a whore, but I am not a thief." She goes, "You're a drunk and a whore and a thief." She goes, "You stole company property, you stole company time." Thank God for firm sponsorship, because I thought, because I did not stick my hand in the till, that I wasn't a thief, but I stole constantly. If it wasn't nailed down, I took it. And so one night I'm standing at a lectern with two of my coworkers, women that I've actually run into in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in Los Angeles. I hope they are still sober today. And this restaurant was super fancy schmancy. They had calligraphists handwriting the checks. And we were standing there talking, and one of the waitresses was walking through the center of the restaurant. And this restaurant was very formal, floor length aprons, crisp white shirts. And we would hold the trays up high on finger point and move through the restaurant. It was almost balletic the way that we would move. And one of us was walking through the restaurant. She was half in the bag like the rest of us were. She lost her balance. The tray started to topple. It flew out of her hand. She slid across the floor. Her face landed smack dab into Jack Nicholson's lap. And Jack looks down and looks up and says, "Jesus Christ, the service in this place is great. There's pasta hanging everywhere. There's food all over the place." And that's the kind of employees we were. You know what I mean? And so our shifts would finish. And NYPD off-duty security for the, they were off-duty, there was security for the restaurant. They would check everybody's handbag, everything as they left to make sure nobody was stealing. And I would have large handbags, it was the 80s, and I would leave the restaurant and I would put on a Southern accent. I don't have a pronounced Southern accent. I don't know if you've noticed or not. And but I would leave and I'd say, "Bye-bye, thank you." And they'd say, "Oh, she's fine. We don't need to check her bags." And meanwhile, in my bag, I'd have a leg of lamb, bottles of Calvados, stemware. I would have picked up stuff so that I could have a dinner party at my house on the night the restaurant was closed. Yes, I was most definitely a thief. And so I would go back to my apartment and I would get ready. And in New York City, you don't go out until after midnight. And I would tease my hair and drink Chardonnay, probably smoke something, waiting for it to get to midnight. I'd get drunker and drunker and higher waiting. And my hair would get bigger and bigger. I used to spray my hair with this stuff called stiff stuff hairspray. My hair would not move. And I loved it because we had cockroaches that were like this big in New York City and you could spray them and they would freeze. And I don't know if it's because I'm a woman and I like a multi-purpose product, but I loved my stiff stuff hairspray. I still pine for it at times. Anyway, so we would go out to these bars and it would be like King Tut's Wawa Hut and the Limelight, and Studio 54 back then was opening and closing and opening and closing, trying to relaunch again. And then after the bars would close, we would go to these places called after hours clubs, you guys. And it was like, I guess the way maybe raves are today, but it was like underground, and you would go underground and you'd say so-and-so sit, and you'd get in. And it was like this makeshift dance floor and this makeshift bar. And I saw people doing things in public I couldn't believe they were doing, and people were drinking just like me, and they were doing drugs and partying. And I thought, these are my people. I finally found where I fit in. And then I experienced what we talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous is pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And that is, I remember coming up out of this underground club into the street in the light of day. I remember vividly, I was wearing a white dress and it had big shoulder pads because it was the 80s, and it had epaulets on it and they were torn and hanging off. And I was filthy from head to toe, and I was staggering to the edge of the curb to hail a cab. And I remember a man and a woman walking past me, and she had her hair and makeup done, and he was in a crisp white shirt and he was clean shaven, and their gaze caught my gaze as they walked by me, and I experienced that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization because they were looking at me with such disgust and disdain. And I did what we do. I went home and I pulled the vodka out of the freezer and I had another drink, because now I don't decide whether I'm going to drink or not. The drink is in charge. And like that frog in a pot of cold water that's slowly ticking up the heat, I am starting to boil alive in my own alcoholic juices, and I don't even know it. And remember the vocal coach that I was supposed to get? I got him, right? He was an opera teacher, and he taught at 112th and Cathedral Street, but he had five contemporary vocalists, and I was one of them. Except you can't count on me, because the drink is in charge, and I've already told you it dictates everything. And I remember going to a lesson with him once, and I'd been up probably for a couple of days. I'd been drinking, snorting, and smoking. And I go in to vocalize, and what came out was air, because I'd blown out my vocal cords. And I'll never forget it, you guys. He cupped my face very paternal-like and drew me toward him. And he said, you know you're going to come here. He says, you know you're going to study voice with me. He goes, why would you waste my time? He said, why would you spend a lot of money. Why would you waste your money? And I did what we do, you guys. I never went back. Remember, that was the dream, and it's ending now, because the drink is in charge. And if you were running the streets with me back then and you said, hey, Heather, you look like you're hitting it hard, two things would happen. You were cut out of my life, or I wondered what was wrong with you, you know? And so the dream is ended, and I'm not in charge anymore. The drink dictates everything. And this guy that I met, nice guy, he was an actor, poor soul. I feel so sorry for him. He was studying with Uta Hagen or Lee Strasberg or one of those big dogs. And he'd landed a film, and he had to go to LA to do the film. And so I came to Los Angeles to be with him. To be fair, he didn't ask me to come, but I know he wanted me there. I did an inventory on it. I know that's stalking now, but I swear to God, I wish I had a picture of that guy's face when he opened up the door and he said, oh my God, it's you. And I'm like, it's me. Anyway, I ended up in Playa del Rey, Westchester. That was a short-lived relationship. And I went from high-end restaurants in New York City to a job at the Fireside Bar and Grill on the corner of Lincoln and Manchester. And I bet some of the old farts in this meeting will know who where it is. If you're new, let me just paint the picture for you. This door opens early. People drink the way that I do. Nobody's counting anybody's drinks. It's red Naga hide leather. The bar mats behind the bar have this sour beer smell. I don't think they've ever been washed. In the corner, there's a piano. It's a piano bar, of course it is. And there's a guy named Bill playing the piano. And Bill has an acute case of emphysema. He's got an oxygen tube stuck up his nose and a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. And when he plays, he growls into the microphone. And every once in a while, I sing a song and I belt out a song or two, and somebody will throw me a 50 or 100. And that's my life. It's getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and I don't even know it. My coworker, Renee, is my cocaine dealer. And again, smaller and smaller and smaller. And so one night, a friend of mine, Tim, comes in and says, I'm working tomorrow at the Sidewalk Cafe in Venice. Why don't you come over there and meet me after my shift, and we'll go out and go clubbing? I said, great. I'd been on the beach all day, you guys. I drank a bottle of Chardonnay, and I come into the restaurant, change my clothes, and I sit down at the bar. And there are three men to the left of me. And they offer to buy me a drink. And I'm like, sure, whatever. But I'm already half in the bag, and I don't realize it didn't come from the bartender. They put it in front of me. And in no short order, what happened was I was drugged and abducted and taken to a hotel room in Venice. And this is not Venice now. This is Venice in the 80s when it was pretty seedy looking. And I'm sitting in this hotel room on the edge of the bed, and I'm thinking, I'm a nice girl from Knoxville, Tennessee, and I'm in trouble. And so I say to the guy, look, I'm going to call my roommate and tell him I'm not going to come home. I'm going to hang here and party with you. And he said, okay. And I pick up the phone and I call my roommate, Carl, and I say, Carl, I'm in a hotel room with three men. I think I'm going to be raped and possibly murdered. If you never see me again, I wanted you to know that that's what happened to me. And I hung the phone up. And let me tell you something. When I did my inventory and I told my sponsor, really, I only hurt myself. Carl would have begged to differ with you. He said it was the worst night of his life waiting to see what happened to me. I sat back down at the edge of that bed, and I was in and out of lucidity, and I couldn't focus. And a voice, as clearly as I'm speaking to you now, said, get up and run. And I don't know where that came from. I do now, but I did not know at that moment. And I ran to the door and I ran out into the street, and I'm running down the street. And I don't know if you've ever had one of those dreams where you feel like your feet are in quicksand, but that's how I recollect it was. I kept stumbling and running and stumbling and running. And I see three men chasing me. And I look back and I see two men standing off in the distance. And one of them pulled up in the van and he says, get in the van, I'll take you home. I didn't know they drugged you. And I look at those guys standing down the road, and I look at the guy in the van, and I got in the van because God did for me what I could not do for myself. And I, that guy took me home and nothing happened. Now, this is a mixed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm expected to share in a general way, but let me say this to you without any sort of disclosure. Horrible, terrible things happened to me when I drank, and I was willing to pay the price to be able to drink the way that I wanted to. I had some strange sense of peace that one day my body would be found in a field. It was a lot of serial killers in the 80s, you guys remember? And it gave me a sense of peace because I was too chicken to kill myself, but I was that far down the hill in my drinking. Does that even make sense? And so the next day, my friend called me. That was my coworker and cocaine dealer. She called me and said, I heard what happened. And I said, yeah. And I was having problems functioning. And she goes, I want to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you like to go with me? And this is my first thought, you guys. She is such a pig. I will go support her, but I don't have a problem. So I end up going to the Marina Center, whose motto is where the debris meets the sea. I love that. I was greeted by a gauntlet of greeters on either side. Everybody looked like they were smiling a little too much, and it was slow motion. And I get in and I sit down, and my friend Renee is to the left of me, and this woman to the right of me was to become my first sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the woman standing at the podium was telling her story. She had come from a very affluent family in Hollywood, and she had servants and Bentleys, and she ended up a prostitute down on Skid Row. And I turned to Renee and I said, that is so sad. And the woman that was to become my first sponsor to the right of me tapped me on the leg and said, at least she had the presence of mind to get money for it. I remember thinking that was a little intense. Yeah. Anyway, she went on to say she was a prostitute on Skid Row and now she's a lawyer, which is, you know, not so different. But anyway, what she did was she started talking about the disease of alcoholism. And I don't know if you've ever been in a meeting and your chest is just pounding because they're telling your story and you feel found out. And I was flushed. I realized that they were telling my story. Anyway, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I did everything you asked me. I got commitments and I went to meetings and I had a sponsor and I was working the steps, but there were two things I wouldn't do. Everybody knew a little bit about me, but there wasn't one person that knew absolutely everything about me. And I would have given you my last dime, but I couldn't have asked you for one. I didn't know how to ask for help. And if you're new, I thought that was humility, but what it was pride masking itself as humility. And I called my sponsor from a gig out in Ojai, California and said, I'm leaving AA. I don't think I'm an alcoholic. She says, good for you. I said, don't you want me to stay? She says, honey, if you don't want to be here, we don't want you here. It's for people who want it, not for people who need it. And so I left AA, and inside of 9 months, I lost everything I had gotten in that little over 2.5 year period. And I came back, you guys, as willing as the dying can be. If you said, hey, Heather, how's it going? I would vomit every feeling, thought, and emotion all over you and then find another warm body to tell it to. You know, and I did everything I was asked to do in AA. And right around about 4 years of sobriety, all my girlfriends were getting married and getting boyfriends, and my personal best in relationships, you guys, 3 months. I was not a vision for you in the dating department. I can tell you that. Anyway, I said to my sponsor, I said, oh my gosh, she's got a boyfriend. She's got a fiance. She said to me, Heather, there is a lid for every pot. And I'm like, what if I'm a casserole dish? You know, how's this work? She goes, just do AA, you know? And so anyway, I met this nice guy. He's a normie. He's not like any of us. He drinks a beer and he stops with like that much left. And I'm like, aren't you going to finish it? He goes, no, I don't want to. It makes me feel funny. I'm like, that's the point, you idiot. Now drink. He's like, no, I don't want to be out of control. He is so not like us. When I went to his apartment, he had framed pictures of William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy. And I go, oh my God, you're a Trekkie. And he goes, no, I'm a Trekster. I'm like, what's the difference? He goes, the sign for Trekkie. He says, I don't live in my parents' basement and I've kissed a girl before. And ladies, when I say he's nice, the only thing that this guy and I have in common is we can both count on one hand the number of women we've been with. He's such a nice guy, you know. And so he foolishly asked me to marry him, and we proceeded to have two really great kids. I remember I took my boys to school to be tested so that they could be placed in the classes, and I was so nervous, and because of my learning disabilities and being acutely aware of it. And when she came out, I said, are they smart? Are they like me? And she's like, no, they're exceptionally smart. She says they're some of the smartest kids I've ever seen. And they actually graduated from high school, summa, both of them, and they're now in college. But anyway, when they were little, my husband would come home from work and yell, I'm going to beat the children. And he'd run and they'd run screaming. And I was clearing out their backpacks and I was reading all their artwork. And the teacher would write down what they had drawn. And I'm looking and it says, this is my daddy beating me. And I go, oh my God. And I flip the page and it says, this is my daddy beating my brother. And I'm like, oh no. And I flip the next page and it says, this is my mom. She's an alcoholic. I was like, oh my God. And I put on my clothes. I run down to school. I'm knocking on the door. Oh good. They're just getting out of prayer time. This will be lovely. I'm like, see the whole picture. And I'm a member of AA. And I just want to, she goes, Heather, it's okay. He told us you were an Alcoholics Anonymous. So my kid outed me at their private little Christian school to everybody. But the good news was, is that I could be of service there. And if there were parents that had problems, they knew who to come to and see what, you know, what was an option for him. We serve others outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what we do. We're of service to all. Anyway, I need to get to where I need to go right now, because I got a little bit of time left. So my husband and I have been in LA for quite a few years. He works in the film industry. But we wanted to move back to Knoxville. And if you're like, why are you moving back to Knoxville? You hated Knoxville. And what happened was I hated Knoxville, gave it the one finger salute, moved to New York, hated New York. And then I got to LA and I got sober. And what I realized is I didn't hate Knoxville and I didn't hate New York. I hated me. And so I worked on the things that I didn't like about myself and I changed it and I wanted to come home. And so I came home to Knoxville, and in no short order, my mother was here. My father-in-law moved from LA and my mother-in-law moved from Florida. And so there's my whole family now in Knoxville. Let me tell you this. My mother's a hardcore Southern Baptist. My father-in-law had been married and divorced 9 times. And my mother-in-law was one of the original Playboy bunnies from the Chicago Playboy Club. My house was interesting. Anyway, so there I am in Knoxville, and my life is good. I've started this meeting, and in my life, I sponsor a lot of women, and I'm doing service work. And all of a sudden, I'm starting to get sick, you guys. And I'm starting to go to doctors, and they can't figure out what's wrong with me. And I've seen every doctor in Knoxville, and then they send me to Vanderbilt. And then I saw a bunch of doctors at Vanderbilt. And all the time, all this stuff is going on. I'm doing service work. I'm doing what I'm asked. I'm sponsoring women. I'm being a wife to my husband, mother to my kids, like we're taught, suit up, show up. And my prayers to God are, God, help me to learn what I'm supposed to learn from this. And then God, help me to learn the lesson and use it to help somebody else. And so after I'd seen a bunch of doctors, I'm sitting in my doctor's office and my husband is sitting in the corner of the room. And he said, Heather, you've got some problems. We know some of what's wrong with you, but we can't figure everything out. And he said, so I'm going to send you to the Cleveland Clinic. He said, but the drugs that they want to give you right now are dangerous for somebody like you. And my husband's sitting in the corner of the room and he goes, it doesn't matter. She won't take them. Let me be clear. There's a pamphlet in Alcoholics Anonymous for everything. There's one on medication. What you do with medicine is between you, your sponsor, and God. I'm not telling you what to do. I'm telling you what is right for me. So I'm sitting in this doctor's office and he goes, I think it's dangerous for you to take these drugs given your history and who you are. Is this my life now? So I go home. I'm sitting on my back patio. You guys, I live in the deep woods. And when I say deep woods, I was literally driving down the road the other day and there was a turkey standing in the middle of the road looking at me like, come at me, bro. I mean, I live in the woods. I have deer in my yard. There are fireflies in the woods and it looks like nymph and fairy. And I'm sitting on my beautiful back patio looking at the deep woods, talking to my sponsor, Pat. And talking is a loose term. I'm screaming at the top of my lungs to her. I said, Pat, I don't want to drink and I don't want to use and I don't want to kill myself, but how am I going to live with this pain? What am I going to do? And Pat has, if you've ever heard Pat Weiss speak, she has this, how do I describe it? It's like buttery, kind of dulcet toned, even smooth voice. And I'm hysterical. And she goes, you know, I was speaking at a conference up in Washington State with Georgia B. You know Georgia B, don't you? And I'm like, yes, Pat, I know who Georgia B is. Now I'm getting irritated because she's so calm. She goes, oh, right. She goes, you guys were in the same home group. I go, yes. She goes, I think you should call Georgia B. I think she can help you with your problem. And I'm thinking, did she just hear what I said? I don't want to drink and I don't want to use and I don't want to kill myself. But I can't live this way. But what came out is, okay, I'll call her. And I pick up the phone and I call Georgia B. And just like that, my life changed. A day at a time, a moment at a time, Georgia B is walking me through this process. I call her some days and say, Georgia, I can barely move. It's difficult for me to breathe. She says, it's okay, honey. I'm going to walk you through that. And other times I'd send her a text and I'd say, I had a good day today. And she said, good, you know. And so this is my life now. And I'm thinking, I can't believe this is my life. I think in my mind, all those prayers were, unbeknownst to me, were, God, help me to learn the lessons that you would have me to learn. God, help me to use this to help somebody else. Then I didn't know how it happened, you guys, but it went to, God, please make it stop. And then it went really like that frog in the pot of water when my alcoholism was taking over. It went, God, I hate you. And I was separated then from God. I was no longer on the shore of faith. I was on the bridge of reason and I didn't even know it, you know? And so I say, this is my new normal. And Pat says, you know what? You gave up all your speaking dates. You need to start speaking again and start being of service to other people. And I said, okay, I guess that's what I'll do. You know, I thought there was some quid pro quo, you guys. Does this make sense? I know it's wrong, but I thought, I'm suiting up and showing up. I sponsor 12 and a half women. And you know, that half woman that I'm talking about is the one that you see in the meeting all the time that says, oh, that's my sponsor. But every time you ask her to work the steps, she cancels on you. So I sponsor like 12 and a half women. I have commitments and meetings and everything. I thought God owed me something. God doesn't owe me anything. If I got what I deserved, I'd be dead or incarcerated. But in my convoluted alcoholic mind, I thought God owed me something. Pat said, you need to get out of yourself and be of service. And so of course, as soon as she says that, somebody called me from Dallas, Texas, and says, my speaker canceled. Can you come and speak at my Eat and Speak? And I said, sure. So I'm in Dallas, standing at a podium, talking, and I'm all over the place. And right in the middle of my talk, this guy's face pops into my head so strongly, it threw me off track. And it's like, wow, that was weird. And this guy's like that chick or that guy in a meeting that you would hear, and you're not friends, but you're more acquaintances. And every time they share, you'd be like, oh my gosh, that is such a good share. I identify with this person always when they share. That was that guy, but he popped in my head during my talk. And then I was like, what? And I finished my talk. I get back to my hotel room. I look him up on Facebook to see if there's something going on. It was just so out of character that he would pop into my head. Nothing on Facebook. And I get back to Knoxville Monday morning. I'm sitting in my driveway. I'm about to go to my house of worship, Walmart. Listen, don't judge me. I'm just saying, I told my husband, I said, if I die, I want you to cremate me and I want my ashes sprinkled over a Walmart super center. I said, I like a place where you can get your tires changed and buy a goat cheese log. And he said, babe, I'll go you one better. He says, I'll put happy low price leader signs at either end of your coffin. That's all mine, ladies, back off, he's mine. And let me tell you, we're about to celebrate 24 years of marriage. And I said to him, can you believe it's been almost 24 years of marriage? And he goes, no, honey, I can't. He says, it feels like 24 minutes. And I said, oh, and he said, underwater. Anyway, so I'm sitting in the driveway and I'm about to go to Walmart and I have this weird feeling again, I need to find this guy, right? And so I look him up on Facebook and I private message him and I say, listen, this is gonna sound crazy. I don't know if you're going through something, but if you need to talk, here's my number. I said, if everything is cool, please just disregard this message as the rantings of a 55-year-old postmenopausal woman and have a lovely day. And I pushed send and I felt so much better. And I know that sounds kind of hooey gooey, but it is in fact the truth. And so I get to Walmart, it may be 10 minutes from my house, and my phone's ringing and it's that guy. This guy's like 6'6". He's got a shaved head, a goatee, biker leathers. He looks like if you looked at him kind of sideways, he'd stab you in the neck with a rusty screwdriver. He is not warm and fuzzy looking. Do you know what I mean? He is intense and he's on my phone and he's like, how the blank do you know what's going on with me? Are you reading my mail? I mean, he is cussing me up and down. He sounds like a rabid animal. And I was so taken back. I'm like, wait a minute. I said, what's wrong? And he said, I'm in trouble. And he's got a couple more years than me. I said, did you drink? And he said, no. He said these words to me. He says, I don't want to drink and I don't want to use. And he says, and I don't want to kill myself, but I don't know how I'm going to do this. And you know how in our AA journey, we have hindsight. This was some real time stuff. I said, oh my God, it really like hit me. I go, this is what this has been all about. And I said, I get that. And I told him the story that I've just shared with you about what's going on with me and how I let God be separated from me by my illness and how I'd gotten so angry at God. And he proceeded to tell me how he had let money, property, and prestige separate him from God. He was sponsoring guys. He was doing the same thing I was doing, but he let it come between him. And I said, did I ever tell you the story about this woman down the road from me? And he said, no, I don't think so. I said, I'm going to say this to you. I live in a hollow, but if I said that in East Tennessee, they'd be like, a do what? I live in a holler. And you have to go up some switchback roads to get up to a main road. And so I'm telling him, I said, I'm going up the switchback to get up to a main road. And I said, I've got my kid and another kid in the back seat. And I said, I look over and there's a woman laying in her yard and there's a car up on a mound of dirt and the wheels are spinning and she's clearly had an accident. And I whip my car into the driveway next to there and I jump out and I run over. And as I run over, she jumps up like she's on a spring. I tell him, and I said, she's got a gash in her forehead and she's covered in bandages. And I said, she looks like a torn up alley cat. She's drunk and she's high and she's kind of staggering. And I said, oh my God, let me get you an ambulance. And she said, no, this is my house. And she pointed to the house and I knew she wasn't going anywhere because her old junky car, the axle on the front end was broken. And so I had my kid and another kid in the car who's never been around alcoholics and his eyes were like saucers. And my kid was like, eh, he grew up around AA. So I got this kid out of there and I got him home. And I told this guy on the phone, I said, I thought about her constantly. Every day I drove by there, I thought, if I see this woman, I'm going to stop and I'm going to talk to her and see if she'd like to go to a meeting with me. And I said to him, I never saw her from that day until this day. And he said, and what was this day? And I said, I'm driving down that same road. I said, it's about 8:30 in the morning. And I said, I look over and she's laying in her yard. I said, she's completely nude. And I said, her head is facing the road. It's sideways. I said, her arm is covering her bosom and her leg is flopped over so you can't see her private parts. I said, her crystal blue eyes were looking at the road and she had flaming red hair that was flailed back. I said, she looked like a Botticelli painting. I said, she was so peaceful. I said, she wasn't suffering anymore. And I began to hear this guy on the other end of the phone, this big 6'6" guy start to cry. I said, sweetie, if you and I don't push into the center of Alcoholics Anonymous, if we do not redouble our efforts and seek God and serve others, that's you and I. And I said, and if we go out, we won't make it back. We've got a lot of time. Our egos are so huge. We will not make it back. And so this guy changed everything. He sold a couple of his cars and bikes and sold the house in Knoxville, moved back to his home state, and he's seeking God again. And that's not the end of the story, though. You know, that was that moment where I said to him, you know, I said, you got to ask yourself what series of events had to occur for me to be the woman that found her in that car accident, to be that woman that found her when she died, to be sitting in a car here talking to you about this. There is nothing is wasted in God's economy. He changed his life and started seeking God again. And so I would drive by that house all the time. And the house that was dead was now alive. There were toys in the yard and flowers being planted. And I wanted to find out who was living there, if it was the daughter or son. I didn't know, but Pat said it wasn't my place to interrupt their life. And so I'm sitting in a hotel room in Jacksonville, Florida. The Tennessee Vols are playing in the Tax Slayer Bowl a year ago. Go Vols. And we won. And I'm looking on Facebook, and there's a message from a woman. She says, my name is Ashley. She says, I read your name in the police report and I heard the 911 tape and I believe you're the woman that found my mother. And if you are, I would like to talk to you. And I said to my husband, cancel the Uber. We're going to go a little late. I have to make a call. And so I call this woman. I said, I am the woman that found your mother. And she starts sobbing hysterically. I said, take a deep breath. I said, honey, I got to tell you, I saw your mom the day she had the accident. And I told her the whole story I've just told you. And I said, I believe with everything that I am, I was meant to find your mother. I said, because I was seriously thinking about how am I going to do life on life's term? And I didn't know if I was going to be able to do it. And your mother absolutely saved my life that day. And I believe that she saved the life of a friend of mine. And I said, no matter how long I speak in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm going to talk about her until the day I die. I said, it was the most horrifically precious moment of my life. And she said, Heather, my family believes you were meant to find her too. God, I hate being a crier. Can I just say how much I hate being a crier? I used to make fun of people that cried. Now I'm that chick. And I'm an ugly crier. Anyway, I would think, suck it up. There was this chick that used to cry all the time. And I would say, oh my gosh, suck it up. I'm that chick now. Anyway, she says, Heather, my whole family lives on this road. We believe you were meant to find her. I said, what? She says, my two brothers live up the road. Myself and three cousins live down the road. We drove by the house. We never saw her. We believe you were the one that was meant to find her so that we didn't have to see her. It's crazy. If you're new, I've talked a lot about God. And listen to me when I say this with everything that I am. I'm the least likely person to be talking about God to you. Because I was the one in the 12 and 12 that it talked about, not like the atheist that knew God didn't exist or the agnostic that doubted the existence of God. I was the one that believed in God but found him wanting. Because where was God when all that terrible stuff was happening to me? Listen to me when I say this. God was with me in that hotel room when I was sitting on the edge of the bed. And he was with me in that doctor's office when I got that horrible news. And he's with me right now. I made choices and decisions in my drinking and using that put my life in situations, and God didn't have anything to do with that. And so though miraculous is an overused word, I will say that I've had miraculous experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my eyes have been opened up in such a way just recently where I'm seeing miracles that I wouldn't have seen before. And it's amazing. You know, I want to share this and then I'll shut up. Sometimes because of how I feel lately, I'm an alcoholic by nature, right? So my thinking is alcoholic. I'm sitting in a doctor's office because kind of that's my jam now. I go to doctors all the time and they're running an hour late and I'm getting really pissed and I'm thinking, I can't believe this is my life and I'm miserable and woe is me in my head, self-pity, self-absorbed. And the tech comes and gets me and brings me into the room and she's going to do the workup before the doctor comes in and sees me and she's typing on the computer and she's looking back and asking me questions and typing. And she looks at the work order from the Cleveland Clinic and she says, my God, she turns around. She says, you have the same disease as my mother. And I sat back. I said, it's extremely rare. And she goes, it's awful. And I said, yes, it is. I said, your mother must be in a lot of pain. She said, it's awful. We brought her here from New Jersey to take care of her. And I said, I'm so sorry, honey. And she turns back around and she starts typing. And then I hear her say these words. She said, she can't stop drinking. And my first thought is, now you are just showing off, God. I said, what did you just say? And she turns back around. She says, she can't stop drinking and taking pills. And I go, I get that. I said, how many techs are in this office? She goes, I don't know, like 10 or 11. I said, what are the chances that you got me? And she's like, well, what do you mean? And I said, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, honey. And I wrote my number down on a piece of paper. I said, please tell your mother if she wants to talk about her disease or her disease, I'll be glad to talk to her. And when I walked out of that doctor's office, you guys, my head was quiet. There was no noise. You know, my job is to seek God and serve others. I've been on the shore of the bridge of reason and the shore of faith and back and forth in this last couple of years. And my feet are on the shore now. And I want to say to you, if you're new and you can't figure out how this is all going to work, let me just say this, job or no job, wife or no wife, your candidate won, your candidate lost, pandemic or no pandemic, you seek God, push into the center of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're going to get the most amazing life you ever dreamed of. I want to thank you for my life.
Thank you, Heather. That was fantastic.